Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show. Led Zeppelin, Good Times, Bad Times, the opening track from their eponymous debut album, Led Zeppelin, released on the 12th of January 1969, 3 days after Jimmy Page's birthday.
Ooh.
And mine.
Yes.
Not the same year.
1969.
Indeed.
Now, we're talking about Led Zeppelin.
We are.
I've been thinking about this. Because, you know, I do a lot of research for these shows. And
do you?
I think I'm starting off calm, okay? Let's just start the Supertone Show off calm this week.
Okay.
Let's start at the very beginning. I want to sort of feel like I'm reading a story because I want to know where they came from.
Okay.
Because everyone knows Led Zeppelin, but I don't know where they came from.
Well,
so
let's find out.
This is what I found out. Okay. In 1966, London-based session guitarist Jimmy Page joined the blues-influenced rock band The Yardbirds, and he was replacing a guy called Paul Samwell Smith on the bass guitar. Now, Page soon switched to guitar, which created a dual lead guitar lineup with Jeff Beck. Now, later that year in October in 66, Jeff Beck left the group. And also, Page was tired of constant touring and wanted to form a supergroup with Beck and himself on guitar, and he wanted The Who's Keith Moon on drums and John Entwistle on bass. Now, he also thought about Steve Winwood and Marriott for the project. Steve Marriott, I should say, the two Steves. So, the Yardbirds played their final gig in July 1968 at Luton College of Technology in Bedfordshire. Are you with me?
Yes, I'm
good.
With you.
Now, they were still committed to several concerts in Scandinavia, so drummer Jim McCarty and vocalist Keith Relf authorised Page and bassist Chris Dreja to use the Yardbirds name to fulfil the band's obligations. Now, they asked this guy called Terry Reed if he wanted to take over lead vocal duties. He said no, he wasn't interested, but he suggested a guy called, exactly, a guy called Robert Plant, who was singer with a band called A Band of Joy and Hobbs Tweedle.
Mm.
Now, that's just crazy. We'll go back to that in a sec. So eventually, apparently Rob turned up at Page's Boathouse or something. We had a bit of a chat and they talked about the creative path. And anyway, he eventually accepted and he recommended his former Band of Joy mate, who was the drummer, John Bonham.
Correct.
So Drejar dropped out to become a photographer and John Paul Jones inquired about joining the band because his wife said to him, why don't you go and ask the guys if... Good on his wife, I say.
So do I.
I want to know her name, actually. They don't say her name, and that's one of my things on my list. It was, what was the name? Or what is the name of
Let's call her Doris Jones for the time being.
Okay, no. Cool woman. Anyway, Paige knew John Paul Jones from working session musicians before, and they played together for the first time. This is all of them together. I'll start again. So they all played together for the first time in a room below a record store on Gerrard Street in London.
Mm.
And the band completed the Scandinavian tour as the New Yardbirds, playing together for the first time in front of a live audience at Gladsaxe Teen Clubs in Denmark on the 7th of September 1968. And later that month, they began recording their first album, which was based really on their live set. And the album was recorded and mixed in 9 days, and Jimmy Page covered the costs. And that's where it all began.
I'm reading Jimmy Page's biography at the moment, and it's fascinating. It's written by a guy called Chris Sailwich, or Sally Witch, I don't know. It's absolutely fantastic. Shows a very dark side of Jimmy Page and very ruthless and very, you know, he was a master financial accountant. He loved money.
Really?
And he was very, very...
In terms of being savvy.
Oh, totally savvy, yeah. Right from the word go. And the thing is, not a lot of people know this, but by the time Jimmy Page joined the Yardbirds, he was actually very wealthy from his session playing. And he'd written a lot of songs as well that had been hits. And I didn't know this. So he'd written songs that had been hits. So he was actually getting royalties already. And he had this lovely house, and that's where his boathouse came from.
Yeah.
His boathouse was on the side of a river.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic. Yeah. So he actually was really, really... Oh, that's Bob in the background there. She's trying to join in.
The girls, yeah.
That's one of our Labradors.
Bobby. Brian. Bobby Brian, we call her.
Yeah, so it's an incredible story of... But he was totally focused, Jimmy Page, on creating a supergroup. He was very sexual. He was very... apparently very, very engaging when you met him. But there was a dark side to him, which came from, of course, this liking of loving of the occult, or his fascination with the occult,
yeah,
which manifested itself later on. But anyway, back to Good Times, Bad Times and Led Zeppelin. This album was a complete breakthrough and people didn't know what to do with it. Because when they played it I think they played it to Mick Jagger, and Mick Jagger just didn't get it at all.
Okay.
And, you know, they just didn't understand it. They didn't think it was going to do well. They had no idea because they were in a completely different market. And when they started playing in Denmark, you know, it didn't really kick off. You know, we see the live footage now, it's black and white footage, and they play like monsters, but the audience don't really know what to do. They're sort of sat there cross-legged and all that sort of carry on. They came back to England and they were playing shows in front of 20, 30 people, because even though that Jimmy Page had been in the Yardbirds and stuff, and they called it the New Yardbirds originally, it didn't really, nobody sort of got it, nobody was turning up to the gigs. So when they went to the States and with Peter Grant, he actually got them gigs over there, and that's when it kicked off. And it was like a momentum. And they were backing up people like Vanilla Fudge, Iron Butterfly, and literally blowing them off stage. Literally. Not just with the performance, but the volume and the energy and the sexual tension that was created. So by the time they finished that first American tour, the album hadn't come out. And it came out, and it instantly got big in the States. I think it was number 20 in Billboard or something. And then they came back home, and they were playing to 20 people still. And it was only the wave of American thing that came back that actually started them to get to really become. And the critics in the UK didn't like them at all. They slated them, even critics in America, because they didn't understand the music, you know? They just didn't understand it. And this album, to me, we play it at least once or twice a month because I've got to remind myself of the basics of sound recording. And the basis of sound recording is you get a great band in a room playing all together, right? Mic'd beautifully and correctly, mixed with, you know, the appropriate amount of compression, a bit of reverb, and that's it. If the songs are great and the musicians are great, it's great. And this sounds great. You know, it wasn't a single. It's perfect length for a single, but they want a single. No. Well, I think that the record company put it out in America, and Peter Grant went absolutely bananas. He was exceptionally upset. But anyway, that's my ranting about Led Zeppelin. I love them. I love Jimmy Page's guitar playing, even though it's all over the place. Later it got scrappy and all that. But he's a master producer. Very, very clever, very articulate, very driven. A lot savvier than you would might think when you see him with his big flared dragon skin trousers on.
You.
Black Rebel Motorcycle Club. Whatever Happened to My Rock and Roll punk song? The third track from their debut studio album, released on the 3rd of April 2001 on Virgin Records. I'm speaking very dark and low.
Well, they are dark and low. Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, great band. In 2001, when this came out, I remember listening to it. We've had them on the show, so I don't want to repeat myself in a lot of stuff that we talked about on that, but they really got me. Disappointed that they weren't British, that's the first thing, but it was a massive, compressed mess. And at the end, the reason why I like this track really a lot, I mean, at the end, it's got very much Jesus and Mary Chain thing going on. There's lots of feedback, lots of stuff happening. And they like finish the track about six times, you know, and there's all that scraping of strings and all that. The bass player, of course, Robert Breen Turner, is it?
Yeah. Levon Bean?
Levon Bean, sorry.
Robert Turner, yeah.
He's amazing. Saw him live, fantastic, fiendishly loud, loads of fuzz on that bass. The first, the opening bit, that doesn't sound like a bass, but it sure is. And when they come firing in there, it's just like, it's a pandemonium. It's pandemonium, isn't it, that track?
It's incredible. Do you know what, the end? I was just sitting there listening to all that soundscape stuff going on.
Yeah.
And it reminded me, can you imagine if you close your eyes and it's the conversation between rusty old cars and trucks in a scrapyard?
You know something, baby, you have the most incredible imagination. That is why I love you. That is the sort of thing.
But that's how it felt like. I'm like, what are they? Because it's almost like whales. They were like,
and then there's that breath at the end as well, which is really weird.
It's a bit Darth Vader-y, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And we've got the headphones on, and it was really like a bit sinister.
Yeah, it is sinister,
that's
yeah.
I was whispering but from inside the wardrobe.
Most of this was recorded at Same City Studios. We know quite a lot about Same City because that is where that big Neve console was.
Of course. Dave Grohl's got now.
Indeed he has.
The saviour.
Yeah. He bought it. And it's a great, if you haven't watched the documentary, it's a great one to watch, isn't it?
It is.
Same City, definitely worth it for all musicians out there who love, well, music, really. Paul McCartney's in it. It shows about Nirvana.
It's really
it talks
cool.
about the history, and it's amazing, you know.
And it was quite dirty, actually. That's one thing I remember. It was a bit of a scene, wasn't it?
Oh yeah.
Oh, you got to. We won't do any spoilers anyway. Just watch it, because if you want to watch something like the journey of bands, because this is the thing I love about this show, is it. Sometimes it's really complicated. It's like you've dropped a load of spaghetti on the floor, and you've got to try and pick out each thread, you know, and they're all numbered. And it's not easy to try and make sense of it all. But the stories are fantastic, and it gives me hope and inspiration, I think, to just live my life, you know, that it doesn't have to be straightforward. It never is anyway. You just sometimes got to react to the waves, haven't you, and just think positive. But before we move on to the next song, I actually went on to Black Rebel Motorcycle Club's website earlier.
Yeah.
It's very dark. And this is their biography. I just wanted to read you this first paragraph because this is really evokes the feel of their music as well. For a select few, rock and roll is a life sentence. It's in every muscle in your body. It's in every thought you have. It's written all over your face. When you arrive at Black Rebel Motorcycle Club's headquarters in East Hollywood, you know you're siding up to the home of some of rock's most primal prisoners. In the driveway, there's motorcycles. In the living room, there's gear splayed everywhere, random bits of drum kits, a pedal steel guitar, stacks of vinyl. Answering the door is a bleary-eyed, chain-smoking Peter Hayes.
When he was 25, speed jive, don't wanna stay alive when you're 25. And when you're stealing clothes from Marks and Sparks, and Freddy's got spots from ripping off the stars from his face, funky little boat race. The television man is crazy, Sam with juvenile delinquent Rex. Oh man, I need TV. Again, I'm a good man. drag. Too many snacks. Now I drunk a lot of wine and I'm feeling fine. Gotta raise some cab to bed. Oh, is there concrete all around? Or is it in my head? Yeah, I'm a goon dance.
All the young dudes.
Hey, goons.
Carry the news.
Where are you?
Boogaloo dudes.
Stand up.
Carry the news. All the young dudes.
I want to hear ya.
Carry the news.
I want to see.
Bought the Hoople and All the Young Dudes released a single 28th of July 1972 on Columbia.
Wow. Mm. Now, Mott the Hoople. I know this song because of David Bowie. I know he wrote it.
Yeah.
But he actually produced this for Mott the Hoople.
He certainly did.
Now, Mott the Hoople. They're one of those bands I have no idea about. I know about them. It's like another one. It's just like a big school lesson for me, this, isn't it, really? But I don't know who they are. But then when I started looking into it, I got really excited because it mentions my hometown, Ross and White.
No.
Oh, I'm so excited. Right, so this is the score with Mott the Hoople. They were formed in 1966 and they were called the Doc Thomas Group. So they had a guy called Mick Ralphs on guitar, Stan Tippins, great name, Stan, on vocals, and Pete Overend-Watts on bass. Now, Ralph and Tippins had been in a local Hereford band called The Buddies. And Watts had been in a local Ross on Y band. We're on the map, sunshine. Called The Solents, with a guy called Dale Buffin Griffin on the drums. That's so exciting. Do you know what? When you grow up in a town and you hear that somebody from your town's in a band, right, or been in a band, it's so inspirational.
You're sort of kind of related to Overend Watts in a way, who sadly died pretty recently, didn't he?
I know. Yes, my former brother-in-law as partner is Jane. Yeah. And that's Pete's sister.
That's right. Yes. So there we are. So we're very close to them.
Yes.
The Overend Wattses.
But it's beautiful, you know. And that's, see, and that's the weird thing is that my brother-in-law Nick, well, now my former brother-in-law, but he taught me Here Comes the Sun and on guitar. So it's really weird, all this kind of connection with the music. It's very odd, but very. I don't stop to think about that because it's just life and I just love it. So well, we've got, go on.
Well, Mick Ralphs, of course, went on to form Bad Company, didn't he, with Paul Rodgers.
Now, I did not know that.
Aha!
He's not the guy off The Muppet Show then.
Absolutely not. And Keith Harwood, the engineer here, is again appeared because he was working at Olympic and Trident Studios and he's the guy that got killed on the same tree.
Oh, no,
again.
Will you stop bringing that blinking tree up again?
It keeps coming out.
Well, it's not funny.
I know it's not funny. He didn't think it was. Neither did Mark Bolan. Very hard trees.
Now.
Anyway.
Right, so we've got Ross and Wye in Herefordshire, just so you know, is on the map. And I think it's fantastic. So anyway, the Doc Thomas Group, they had a residency at a nightclub in a resort town in Italy, you know. And they were offered a recording contract with an Italian label. How cool is that?
Mm.
And they released an eponymous album in 1967. And a year later, both Griffin and organist Verdon Allen joined the band as well. So when they toured the UK, they went under the name, a different name, I don't understand this, but they were called Shakedown Sound, and later they were called Silence. But they recorded some demos at Rockfield Studios in Monmouth. Now, this is interesting because we went to visit Rockfield last year.
That's where Queen recorded. A lot of people recorded.
Indeed, down the road. And so these demos were shopped to EMI, Polydor, Immedia and Apple, but they had no success. Then the group came to the attention of a guy called Guy. So I didn't mean to say that. Guy Stevens at Island, who liked the group, but not with Tippins as lead singer. So they put an ad out saying in the paper, singer wanted, must be image-minded and hungry. It's funny, isn't it? And anyway, they selected Ian Hunter from that advert. And Tippins swapped roles and became the road manager.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So there you go. So, but it's just now I know a little bit more. It clarifies the band because you've got so many different bands and I don't know the individual characters and I don't really know what they look like. So it's difficult for me to find out, to understand the difference. Well, now
lead,
I do.
Well, the lead guitar break on that is one of rock's classics, isn't it? It sort of stands out, you know, Mick Ralph's. Ronson was all over that album as well, but he was arranging. He wasn't actually doing, wasn't playing guitar. But Mick Ralph's. And Ariel Bender was on there, who actually did a bit of guitar on there. And a guy, he's a Facebook friend of mine, actually, a guy called Morgan Fisher. He was in organ and mellotron on some of those tracks.
Really?
As well. Yeah.
We'll get you. Woo.
So, yeah, there we are. So we know all these people, you know, we're connected. But yeah, it's, I mean, David Bowie, though, it's a great song, and the chord structure of it is great. I love the way it changed that major minor thing, you know, A major and A minor. It's really lovely. It's just a great song. He's singing backing vocals, he's all over it. He was an absolute genius.
But the thing is, as well, right, you've got David Bowie, just quickly, going on writing a song for your band, and what happened is he bumped into Pete Watts and he found out that I think Mott the Hooper were thinking about splitting up because they just weren't making any commercial success and they were getting fed up. So he offered them Suffragette City, would you believe? And they turned it down.
Right, okay.
So apparently he sat cross-legged on the floor in a room in London's Regent Street right in front of Ian Hunter and wrote To Order All the Young Dudes to keep the band together.
Unbelievable. And the guitar, that I've got to mention this. If you listen to it on cans, there's that lovely acoustic guitar on the left-hand side, which I've never heard before, really. Until you listen to it on cans, all this stuff opens up.
Oh, my name, it means nothing. And my age, it means less. For the country I come from is called the Midwest. I was taught and brought up to the laws to abide, and that the land that I live in has God on its side. All the history books tell it, they tell it so well. The cavalry's charge and the Indians fell. The cavalry's charge and the Indians died. Oh, the country was young then, with God on its side. The Spanish American War had its day, and the Civil War to us was soon laid away, and the names of the heroes I was made to memorize, with guns in their hands and God on their side. the First World War. It came and it went, and the reason for fighting I never did get. But I learned to accept it, accept it with pride. For you don't count the day it went, God's on your side. In the 1960s came the Vietnam War. Can someone tell me what we were fighting for? So many young men died, so many mothers cried. Now I ask the question, was God on our side? I learned to hate the Russians all through my whole life. If another war comes, it's them we must fight. And to hate them and fear them, to run and to hide, and accept it all bravely, with God on my side. Through many dark hours I've been thinking about this, that Jesus Christ was betrayed by a kiss. But I can't think for you, you have to decide whether Judas Iscariot had God on his side. Oh, now, as I'm leaving, I'm weary as hell. The confusion I'm feeling, ain't no tongue can tell. The words fill my head, they fall to the floor. That if God's on our side, he'll stop the next war. Jesus loves me, this I know.
The Neville Brothers, with God on Our Side, from the album Yellow Moon, released in 1989 on A&M Records and produced by one of our amazing people we love, Daniel Lamar.
Well, to me, it's one of my favourite songs of all time, this. The depth of emotion that Aaron Neville puts into that, because it's basically a solo track with him, it's on Yellow Moon, which incidentally is not on Spotify, it's not. It's you can't get it on there. It's one of Daniel Lanois's the triplet of albums he did with Acadie, Oh Mercy with Bob Dylan, and this one, Yellow Moon. Some of the greatest music that's been produced for a long, long time, and I can't think of stuff that betters it, really, in terms of its production and stuff. the guys involved, Mark Howard and Malcolm Byrne. Malcolm Byrne's a guest producer at Supertone, believe it or not. There we are, he's on our website and stuff. And written by Bob Dylan, of course. But the interpretation is something else, you know. And I think that song and the lyrics are so applicable to today, you know. You don't count the dead when there's God on your side. I mean, my God, what a powerful lyric that is. Bob Dylan at his best, you know. You know, Judas Iscariot, the question is, was God on his side? It's, you know, they make you think, and it moves me to tears every time. Every time. It's one of those records that always does it for me. You know, it's like Famous Blue Raincoat and Jennifer Warnes had another week. You know, they really get me in a way that... And there's not a lot going on. There's all that ambient stuff underneath. But Lanois, you could almost see him mixing that record in a dark room on his own with his Neve console. I think he had a Neve then. I think he had something else. But he'd been mixing it, and it was like, you know, just moving those faders and just getting everything roaring underneath and building it up, which it does build, and those, like, that percussion, that bong and stuff, you know. Magnificent production. And, finally, Aaron Neville, when he was doing this, he did it sat down in front of a dynamic mic in a shed. Well, it was a room, a floor in a place in New Orleans, a temporary studio. And yeah, this is where it's going, temporary studios. That's what Glyn Johns said. Glyn Johns said, the death of rock and roll recording came with the sound designer and SSL consoles. That's what he said.
You're listening to The Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was Weather Report. Yes, it's cold outside. About 8 degrees at the moment, the Isle of Man. Weather Report. Sorry. Birdland, a single from the album Heavy Weather, released on the 19th of April 1977 on Columbia, RCS and ARC record labels. Now, the reason why we've got this vinyl is that we've got a little bit of Red Report. We've got two or three Weather Report albums kicking around. But I went to see Weather Report at the Apollo in Manchester because somebody said, and I wasn't really into jazz, sort of jazz fusion, jazz rock, anything like that. I quite like Marv Vishnu Orchestra and McLaughlin and all that sort of kind of. But he used to play through Marshall Stack for the 11th, like a different thing, you know. But this was like quite jazzy for me. And I went to see him. And I could not believe Jaco Pastorius. He absolutely blew my mind. He was right at the front of the stage. He had this monster acoustic bass stack with a folded horn cabinet. Like, I think it was 18 or something, 15, I don't know. Monstrous thing. And it was fiendishly loud. Not just loud, it was fiendishly loud. And he was absolutely spellbinding. The rest of the band were just almost secondary to him, and they are great musicians, but he was unbelievable. Pinched harmonics, his speed, his dexterity, his musicality, his timing, exemplary. Anyway.
Well, I don't know. I mean, this guy's some kind of legend, isn't he, Jaco?
Oh, yeah.
But this band, Weather Report, it's not Crowded House. It's another band, I know. And I'm thinking about... No, seriously, though, yeah. Weather Report. It's like, because I know this song, yeah. But I wouldn't have said, oh, that's the Weather Report. And it's a really odd thing, so it's like another gap in my knowledge. So they started out as a jazz equivalent of what the rock world in 1970 was calling a supergroup.
Yeah.
But unlike most of rock supergroups, this one kept going for a good 15 years. It more than lived up to its billing. It practically defined the state of the jazz rock art throughout almost all of the time the band was together.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you've got this Austrian-born keyboard player called Joe Zawinul, American saxophonist Wayne Shorter, and I've heard of Wayne.
Yeah.
Now, both had worked in the studio with Miles Davis on his fusion albums In a Silent Way and Bitches Brew. And then you had Czech bassist Miroslav Vitus and drummer Alphonse Mouzon. I love this. And I had a look. Alphonse has got a big beard. I just wanted to know what he looked like with a name like Alphonse Mouzon. And what they were trying to do with this was get away from like typical structures. This is how I'm trying to understand it in lame woman's term or people's term. It's just... there's a certain way of writing and they just wanted to do something different. And that's when Jaco turned up in 1976. Now, this was written, actually, by Joe Zawinul as a tribute to the Birdland nightclub in New York City. And that's where he'd heard people like Count Basie, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington and Miles Davis. And what's really sweet is it's also where he met his wife, Maxine.
Wow.
So... it went to number one in the Billboard Jazz Album charts and it was nominated for a Grammy for Best Instrumental in 77. Now, what's really interesting, did you know that Manhattan Transfer won a Grammy for their version of Birdland? And it had lyrics written by a guy called John Hendricks. Now, I looked up John Hendricks and I was thinking, who is this guy? Now, he's like the poet laureate of jazz, apparently, and he's one of the originators of vocalese. You know, when you add lyrics to instrumental songs and you place the instruments with vocal lines and stuff. So this guy is a legend, and Al Jarreau called him, pound for pound, the best jazz singer on the planet maybe that's ever been.
Every
The Creation and Making Time, which was the debut single released on the 17th of June in that great year of 1966 on Planet Label from the album We Are Paintermen.
The first track to feature a guitar played with a violin bow. This is where Jimmy Page stole it from. Well, he did, because he was a master plagiarizer. You know, Eddie Phillips. And Eddie Phillips was known as probably one of the greatest guitar players kicking around at that time. But nobody remembers him, nobody knows. But everybody said he was just as good as Clapton, you know, as innovative, good as Page, just as good as Beck, just as good as all these guys. And this, to me, sounds like a cross between The Who and The Yardbirds. It's like that sort of thing, which is hardly surprising, of course, because it was produced by Shel Talmy, who actually produced a lot of the Kink stuff and Ray Day stuff and The Who, the early stuff, Can't Explain. So that's probably where it came from. But, you know, the track, I think it's very alive and it just sounds great to me.
It does. I'm just listening back. I'm just thinking about the fact. I'm wondering why they didn't connect, really. Why they didn't have that. Is it the song? So, I mean, they had weak UK sales, didn't they?
Hmm.
But anyway, it's just sad because, you know, you hear this quite often, actually, of people who were just absolutely brilliant musicians and the band should have taken off and for one reason or another.
Well, very innovative, you know. And, yeah. You know, The Move, Jimmy Page, all those sort of people. You know, Pete Townshend was kicking around on that scene, you know. And was he asked by Pete Townshend to join The Who
as a
second guitarist?
He was, I think so. It's just, hang on a minute, let me read my notes.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
But and the thing is, though, they went down really well in Germany. And they're talking about the fact they had this extended residency at the Big Ben Club in Wilhelmshaven. And it was during that time there that they met this local band called the Roadrunners, and they were getting really great crowds coming to see them because of the use of feedback in songs. So that's where Eddie got his inspiration to get that kind of feedback thing as well. Don't know where the bow thinker. I think that might have just been him. We don't know, do we? But
I think it was. I think it was completely original him. Anyway, there you go.
So, well, it's nearly the end of the show, you know.
No.
I know, I just feel a bit sort of, whoa, this week has been so intense and yet so revelationary at the same time. But anyway, thank you so much for joining us. And if you want to get hold of us, you can find us on social media. We've got Facebook, Twitter, at Susie and Simon, and Instagram.
And the show's available on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes, and iHeartRadio.
Now, we're going to play you out with a classic. Now, this is interesting because I didn't really know too much about this guy. In fact, you never know anything unless you know it. Do you know what I mean? I know that sounds weird, but it's like, oh, it's only difficult because, oh, I used to say it's only difficult because you haven't learned it yet.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of thing. But John Mayall, I mean, what an inspiration, this guy. I mean, I don't know whether I'd like him personally. I don't know. I mean, I think he might kick my ass a lot because I think he ran a tight ship as well, didn't he?
Well, he certainly did. And this album, I mean, the Beano album, you know, it's the classic one with Eric Clapton on the front, you know, reading the Beano. And, you know, the whole album, it's produced by the mighty Mike Vernon again. You know, he keeps popping up.
Indeed.
But, you know, it's an absolute classic of British blues. But as we said the other week, it's a lot of the stuff was completely plagiarized off the black musicians, you know, at the States, and then, you know, the audacity of it, sort of recorded in England by Mike Vernon and you know, Peter Green and all this stuff, and then they exported it back to America again.
It's like taking, anyway.
Yeah.
I was going to say, but it was written by Freddie King, you know, and a guy called Sonny Thompson, and first recorded by Freddie King in 1960.
Yeah.
But Freddie King said that Hideaway came from a Hangdog Taylor song called Taylor's Boogie.
Hangdog Taylor, what a great name.
I love all this. A Shaky Jake Harris, a harmonica player who played with Magic Sam, recalled, at that time, me and Sam was playing at Mel's Hideaway Lounge, a Chicago blues club where many of the blues musicians of that era played. And that's where Freddie King's Hideaway comes from. We stole it from Hangdog Taylor, and Freddie King stole it from us.
No.
I think that's great. And so, and it used to be their theme song. It was Magic Sam's theme song. And so Freddie King would come in and jam with them until he learned the song. And it's turned into a blues standard. But one interesting thing, you know, the front cover you've got with Eric Clapton sort of doing the silent protest of not trying to cooperate
by reading the B note.
We know this, don't we? Well, the guy who was the photographer was a guy called Derek Wedgbury.